This House Interim Committee on Government Accountability and Information Technology. Thank you all for being here. And Marjorie, what do we got?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the first order of business is your organizational meeting to adopt your committee rules. These rules were sent out to you last month, and they're the generic rules that each House committee is considering this interim.
All right. We need a motion for this.
Mr. Chair, I move that we accept the House committee rules as proposed, as rules for our committee.
It's been moved that these rules be adopted. Any discussion? Any objection? They're adopted. So let's move on to the informational part of the meeting. What do we got first?
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Dugan Petty, our Chief Information Officer, is here to provide two reports to you. And at your table, you do have his PowerPoint slides that he'll be presenting today.
Welcome, Dugan.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dugan Petty. I'm the state's Chief Information Officer. I'm also the Administrator of the Enterprise Information Strategy and Policy Division of the Department of Administrative Services. That, Mr. Chairman, is half of my presentation. You have in front of you a set of handouts. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity of going over our Enterprise Information Resource Management Strategy with you today. On page 2 of the strategy, get into the background of it. The strategy was begun in September of 2006 and has been adopted effectively this summer and recently signed off. And it is a refresh of a strategy that has been around, but we've really taken a completely different look at what we're doing, and we've updated this information. And it really sets out for the information technology enterprise of the state of Oregon where we're headed and where we're going over the next four-year time horizon. The strategy supports the accomplishments of the governor and the governor's goals and provides a common strategic business objective for the state. One of the things that we really worked hard on in this strategy is beginning to understand the linkages between state business and the business needs of the state and information technology. So as we developed the strategy, we formed a steering committee made up of administrative service managers who are really the business managers and agencies of state government, as well as agency chief information officers. So we've tried hard to link up in this information technology strategy what the business needs are of the state. And it's important for us to have an information technology strategy that really enables business, and I think you'll see that as you go through this. On page 3, we've identified the purpose of the strategy, which is really to communicate a shared vision that guides IT staffing, planning, budgeting, and procurement and delivery of government services. So if we have a strategy that all agencies are looking at and we're looking at as we try to move the IT agenda forward supporting agency business, then this helps communicate that shared vision. It also is useful in prioritizing investment decisions. Is it consistent with the strategy? Is it consistent with the direction we're going in and so forth? And it allows for the effective use of information technology resources, processes, and plans to enable accomplishment of the governor's goals. So if we're aligning with the strategy and we're working the strategy, then we're using our resources in an effective way as opposed to trying to kind of be out covering the whole waterfront. On page 4, we began some key interview points, and I'm going to take a step backwards and tell you that as we refreshed the strategy, we went and renewed a conversation that had been going on with the scenic directors, the agencies that were involved in the data center consolidation. we went back to them and talked to each of them about what their strategic plans were, where are they headed in their business operation, what are their information technology needs. Now, some of the directors have turned over, and so we had a whole new interview, but for those that were still in place from the last time we interviewed them, we went back and refreshed that information with them to make sure that we understand what their needs are for information technology. So there's some key interview themes that came out of those interviews. The first one was they wanted to improve the capabilities of management information and decision support. We heard this loud and clear. They have a mission to accomplish. They have a constituency and a public that they need to accomplish their mission with, and they need good factual information to make decisions on. So information technology used in a way to develop data so that they can make good, solid, real-time decisions is critically important to them. They also told us that they wanted improved administrative information systems that meet agency business requirements. The HR systems, the financial systems, the procurement systems, what can be done around information technology to help streamline those processes and make those systems give them the kind of information to allow them to better manage their organizations. And then another thing that came out that I think we're really just beginning to touch on, and I think this is going to be a thing that we're going to see for quite a while in state government, and that is improving information access, sharing, integration, and transformation. This is really cross-boundary information. You know, back years ago, there were times when an issue faced a particular agency in government, and they had most of the information they needed to make a particular decision. What's difficult today in government is where many times the issues are crossing agency boundaries, and they need to share that information so that they can make decisions that are more complicated than they used to be, and they need information that's collected under a variety of different agencies to come together and make an effective decision. In some cases, it's not just a single agency making decisions, but it's a collaboration between the agencies that makes a decision and provides a service that the public needs. So how do we get that information between agencies and position either a matrix kind of organization to make decisions or position the individual agencies to make collaborative, effective decisions? So sharing information across boundaries. Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. I'm sorry to interrupt, but do you have any idea of what's driving that change?
I think we live in a more complicated world than we lived in 20, 30 years ago, and many of the questions that come to government today are not just simple within a simple kind of siloed box that we operated in 30, 40 years ago. Major 37, for example, you know, it crossed boundaries. It wasn't just one agency that could begin to deal with that issue and resolve it. While there may be one agency that has more lead on it than others, it just didn't stay in a single box. And questions, we've got DHS, Department of Human Services, and our housing department have different information that cross those boundaries. An example that we heard of which I think is a good one, from the Department of Corrections and the Department of Human Services, was about health information records. Well, when a person is incarcerated, that information belongs in the Department of Corrections. But when that person is released, then that information goes to DHS, so that information is crossing boundaries. So I hope that's helpful to you.
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman. In addition, a couple other key points that came out of the interview was the need to streamline and automate the back office processes. What can we do to make those agencies more effective in their back office processes? This is an old one, but converting paper to electronic formats. You know, the promise of moving away from paper to the digital age, that still is a challenge for us. How do we do more of that to enable people to be more effective with managing their information? On page 5, we've got some more interview takeaways. They've asked that we improve the capacity to communicate directly with their customers and to survey their customer needs. Agency heads want to understand where their constituency is at, where their customer is at, and understand, using technology, how they can better achieve those customer needs. So how can they have a pulse on what their customer needs so that they can be more effective in carrying out their mission?
Plain language will help a lot.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Another point that we got from the interview was that the need of skilled, trained, productive, and sustainable workforce. Information technology systems and how we manage information technology, how information technology supports agencies, is really dependent on our ability to bring in and retain staff that can provide that support on an ongoing basis. If we have a high churn of staff moving through organizations, then our effectiveness at maintaining systems and continuing processes is threatened. We have another issue that's looming out there, and that is that we are right on the cusp of seeing a wave of retirements go through the system. Well, that's not new news, but that will have impact in information technology systems as well, because as we lose our veterans that have the skills, will we be in a position to bring on replacements that have the necessary skill sets? Can we compete for them, and can we retain them? And there's some generational issues that develop around this. The people that are retiring tended to see themselves in job situations for a much longer period of time. The people that may be following them in, Generation X, Generation Y, may have a different model for how long they want to be part of an organization. So there are some big challenges that face really all HR components. Mr. Chairman?
Representative Richard, does he go ahead?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Petty, is DAS looking at changing some of the models that are used in the government, for instance, emphasizing telework for IT, obviously, and that would be a real an area that's being done throughout the private sector,
yes,
to a large extent. Also emphasizing the bringing in of interns so,
yes,
that there could be on the job, not only benefiting from them, but also introducing them to the opportunities of working within the state.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Richardson, DAS is in fact looking at both of those options. DAS, not in our information technology group, but in our human resources division, has a teleworking policy that's established. That's I think important, and one of the things that we have to look at, and certainly has an appropriate place, but we have to also balance teleworking with information security issues around that. So there's that's not to say that there's not a solution to it, but we have to be careful when we encourage teleworking that we're doing it in a way that we are managing information security in an appropriate way. So there is a teleworking policy that permits that, and I agree with you that the opportunity to use more of that can help in terms of how we manage the workforce. In addition, your second point was
utilizing interns to a great extent.
Yeah, we had a fairly comprehensive program during the summer to bring in interns into state government, and probably more of an emphasis on that this last year than what we've seen in the last decade that I've been with state government. We brought in two interns in our program alone. That was, again, administered through our Human Resources Division, and there were a variety of interns that came in from a number of colleges that performed very effective work within state government. And I agree that that is a good way of addressing that, because you begin to build that relationship while they're in school, and they begin to see that this could be an opportunity for them when they come out of school. We just recently, in fact yesterday, had a kind of a seminar. We invited a human resources expert from the Gartner Corporation to come and talk to CIOs from agencies as well as HR managers. And then we had one of our staff, Jennifer Laura, a manager from our Human Resources Division, to talk about some of these issues. And both of those ideas were things that came out of that discussion. The idea of engaging with higher education institutions in the area early on, and making public employment an attractive proposition to bring them into the system. There's more that we can do there. So those are two very good points that I agree with. beyond the skilled and trained productive workforce, another thing we heard was the need to improve business case development, prioritization, and selection of resourcing of new enterprise initiatives. What's the business case when we're moving forward with an enterprise initiative? How do we initiate that? How do we make sure that before we put in the budget or move forward with an information technology project, that it has a solid business case, and that solid business case is understood, and we then manage that towards that business case. So this is one of the key takeaways that we heard from the interviews. The last two are really along the same lines, but we need to improve our processes to evaluate the efficiency and the effectiveness of programs and projects, including the ability to gauge customer satisfaction. So as we execute our programs and processes, what are we doing to make sure that they're accomplishing the objectives that they set out for? How are we managing them? What kinds of practices are we putting in place so we're getting effective outcomes out of those projects and programs? And then finally, the last takeaway for the interviews was the establishment of a clear and unified integrated governance model for all enterprise issues. One of the things that we've heard over the last few years is the importance of having a governance model with accountability for making decisions that allows for taking in input, getting a good fix on reality, and yet being accountable for delivering the project. So the need for a governance model was one of the things that we heard. We turn to page 6. That's a good segue into the governance model. This graphic demonstrates a governance model that was agreed to in the strategy and put forward in the strategy. And if you look at it, it's really got three panels. And the panel beginning on the left is a governance model that's proposed during a concept development or project definition phase. It has the DAS director as having responsibility for an enterprise-wide project. It has agency directors forming as an advisory group to provide the DAS director input. It has the state CIO and the DAS deputy involved to bring up through that input from both the administrative service managers and the state CIOs, the CIO council. So in this concept development phase, we've got accountability, but as you can see, we're really reaching out for maximum input into this project to make sure that it makes sense. So we want to get good project initiation by reaching out and making sure we're getting good input. Then as it moves into the project phase, we then transition over into the middle panel, goes through this project initiation. Now we're talking about what's the governance model for implementation and project oversight. Still we have, and this is an enterprise-wide project, we have the DAS director as being accountable, and the people who work for him, who he holds accountable, which would be the state CIO, the state data center administrator, for example. Then, as you see off to the left, he still has an advisory group to reach out to provide recommendations to the DAS director, and that group can form subcommittees as necessary to get subject matter experts to make recommendations for them. This involves a steering committee, so we're getting advice from either the CIO or the state data center manager is getting advice from a steering committee. And then finally, at the bottom, you see the discipline of having a project manager being critical to being successful, quality assurance in place, and then, as necessary, subject matter subcommittees. So then as we move from the project phase into the program phase, now this is now moved into a program and it's operational program, we have a little different governance model, but it's very similar, and effectively it still has that input from agency directors going to the DAS director. It has an advisory committee going to either the state CIO or the state data center administrator, and it has program managers and auditors looking at what the outcome is to make sure that we're still having that quality assurance. So this is the governance model that the strategy moves forward and really addresses that question of governance. Page 7 just outlines the mission and the vision statement that are expressed in the strategy document. The mission is to maximize the value of government information technology investments to best serve Oregonians, and the vision is Oregon government services are optimized through the innovative use of information technology. Now on page 8, we really get into the substance of the strategy. Strategy has 3 goals and 15 objectives that carry out those goals. So the first goal is effectively plan and execute government information technology projects. This is a critical, and it's not accidental that this is the first goal. This is really a foundation goal because part of what's important for state government is building credibility and building trust, building credibility with the legislature, building credibility with the members of the public who see how we execute and spend their money is very critical. This plan, this goal, looks at how we are when we plan and execute those projects. And it has five objectives that are fundamental to how we carry that out. The first one is it's really dependent on recruiting, selecting, and training information technology staff that have the capability to manage and the technical skill sets to complete these projects. If we don't have those skills, we'll have a difficulty carrying these things forward and achieving the success that we need to achieve. The second objective is to implement information technology governance required to manage and oversee the project and information and the portfolio of enterprise information technology projects. And we talked about the governance model before we went to this slide, but I want to say that this is really finding the balance between making sure that we get the input from all the sources necessary and take that in consideration so that we're not headed off in an enterprise project that doesn't make sense. So this goes to having good input in the governance model, goes to having a business case, and then it goes to having an accountable decision right so we know who's making the decision and they have accountability for making it. If we don't have clear accountability and decision in the governance model, we're not going to be successful. So clear accountability is critically important, and we think that that's in this governance model. Objective 1.3 is to develop an enterprise business and technical architecture and associated standards. Enterprise architecture is really the connecting of the dots between the business and information technology. It's mapping those relationships and what the business needs are and how information technology is employed to do that. And from those architectures, then we develop standards. If we don't have an architecture, we really don't have a set of plans on how we're going to construct this thing. So it's really a blueprint for how we execute our information technology. We've got a lot of work to do here, but this is a key piece. So if we're going to be successful, we talked about exchanging information across the boundaries of agency jurisdictions. We do need to have an enterprise architecture that matches up what that business needs to how we deploy the technology. And one of the things we'll talk about later in the presentation on the third set of goals is the work that's being done in the data center. One of the key things that they're doing is developing a technical architecture which will facilitate the consolidation of those different agency data centers that they've brought together. Without having that architecture, you can't bring that about. We also have a need to have a security architecture. So when we have a security architecture in place, then as agency projects come forward, we'll check those against that security architecture to make sure that we're really rowing in the same direction and have a consistent approach to how we're maintaining enterprise security. So the architecture is a fundamental and important piece to how we move forward here. We have a group that's looking at this right now. They are continuing to move forward to develop strategies about how we can bring this architecture together. We have a conference that we're scheduling in November where we're bringing in different people who have built enterprise architectures to talk to us about it and help us go further in this area. The fourth objective in this goal is adopting policies, procedures, standards, guidelines needed to effectively and predictably initiate, plan for, implement, manage, and oversee the state's portfolio of information technology projects. That's a mouthful, but there's a lot of work to be done here, and this really goes to being able to effectively deliver on projects that accomplish what they set out to do, that are on time and on budget, and have the appropriate controls that we can that we can demonstrate to the public that we've been wise stewards of their funds and how we've executed against information technology projects.
Representative Richardson.
Ms. Petty, how can you demonstrate that to the public? I mean, that would imply transparency so that the public would be aware of the projects that are going on and what the time frames and goals are. I mean, how will there be an open accountability?
Well, I think one of the ways you demonstrate that is having more successful projects, although I will tell you that this is an area where information technology projects are prone, they're very volatile, and not just in state government across the enterprise, they're prone to being behind schedule or over budget. So managing to where we're on schedule on budget is a good way to start that. Going back through our processes and our procedures and making sure that they are consistent with really best-in-class processes and procedures and making those known and available, training agencies, I think that'll begin to get those kinds of outcomes that we're looking for. In terms of transparency, I think this strategy is a good step. We're working towards a tactical action plan that lays out the steps of the strategy, and that'll be more specific about the policies that we're implementing. Those policies will be generally available to the public, and so I think that's how you begin to do that.
And if I may, one of the things that I want to see, and I think we will see, is that this committee will be more aware of projects that are going on and how they're going, and that will help with that goal as well.
Sure.
That's one of my goals.
Mm-hmm. So. Makes perfect sense to me.
Continue, please.
Okay. The final objective in Goal 1 is integrate enterprise information technology planning with the biennial budget process. We've talked a little bit about building business cases, but we want to do a better job of integrating that business case development into the budget process so when an information technology project comes forward to get into the budget that it's gone through some rigor around a business case. And then we also want to eventually get to the point where we're making investment decisions around projects in a way that we're not basically saying we're committed to this project to the very end by funding it all up front, but using this notion of investment gates. So we're exploring with BAM what the opportunities are to begin to align these two things. And we are right now working with them on budget instructions for this next budget go-around.
Yes, Representative Anderson.
Were you done with that objective? I just wanted to
yes,
catch
Mr.
it before you go to the next page. On objective 1.1, recruiting, selecting, training, and retaining IT professionals who possess essential management and technical capabilities, in your view, how's the state doing? I mean, it's been in my experience that you can have the best org chart, you can have the best plans on paper, but if you don't have the right people that are really good at getting things done, it's just going to be a plan on paper. So what's your assessment of how the state is doing in competing with the private sector to get those top-notch professionals?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Edwards, I think that's an excellent question, and if you had asked me that 6 months ago, I would have said, I don't think we're doing so well. I don't think that's my answer today for a couple of reasons. We've talked with our HR people about turnover and how we're doing in terms of retention and retaining the skill sets that we brought on. And they've done some sampling, and statistically they can't see where we're not able to compete. I had an opportunity to speak with the human resources specialist for Gartner, who we have under contract. They provide us objective information technology analysis, and we ask them this question about how does the state match up against the private sector, because this issue of turnover, and particularly in some skill sets, the difficulty in getting them in and the difficulty in retaining them, and what we're finding is that it's an industry-wide issue. Mm-hmm. So there are some skill sets that COBOL programmer, for example, is not hard to come by right now. But there are other skill sets like enterprise architects that are that everybody's struggling to bring in. So some of it is just, everybody's struggling with this across the industry, whether you're private or not. Now, the challenges that state government have in some areas may be more difficult. I mean, on the surface, it seems like our compensation package might not be competitive with some of the private sector major IT employers. Well, that may be true, but on the other hand, we have some cards that we can play as well. We are the largest employer in Oregon, and there's a lot of opportunity being with a large employer, number one. Number two, we offer the ability to have maybe more stability and maybe a little more quality of life instead of 60, 70-hour work weeks that some of the IT people in the private sector would have. So part of what we have to do here is begin to do a workforce analysis and a work plan that says, where are we at? Where are we going? Where are our skill needs? And consciously decide how we go about positioning ourselves to either recruit or set position descriptions to be effective to compete for those people. What kinds of things are we doing? As Representative Richardson says, there are some things that we have in our toolbox, telecommuting, for example, or telework, for example, or some things that we can do. The information that we have right now suggests that, yeah, we have something we have to pay attention to and we have to manage, and it's going to take some work, but everybody's struggling with that same thing.
And I've heard some studies that the new group of folks coming up are a bit more concerned about quality of life and doing something of importance.
Yep.
And we have that to offer. We can offer, this is something that benefits Oregon. And I think that's very attractive to some of the young people that are coming up, and some of the really good ones.
I think that's right. And I think there's an opportunity for us to begin engaging. We talk about recruiting at our higher education institutions, but there's an opportunity for us to engage at an early point and begin to make those connections. Our second goal of the strategy is to ensure adequate state government management information and decision support capabilities. We heard from many of the directors the need to have good factual information in a timely way, and sometimes cross-boundary information to make decisions on. So this goal and these sets of objectives really talk to how we do that, how we share that information. The first objective is to develop and improve access to geospatial information in Oregon state government. We have a variety of agencies that have a growing dependency on geospatial information. It's been said as much as 85% of the information that's collected, the data information collected, is geospatial in nature. So how can we leverage that? One agency may collect water information. Another agency may collect habitat information. Another agency needs road information. So how do we overlay that and leverage that so by combining that information, we get even more powerful information that agencies can access and use? So we're working in an initiative around the Oregon Navigator Project to begin to try and bring that together within both state and local governments. Objective 2.2 is deploying statewide administrative information systems that meet agency requirements. These are the key kind of data points that agency directors need to know so they can make good decisions about how they manage and their managers manage their programs. Where are they at financially? Where's this contract at? Where's this recruitment at? Where are they going to be at it? Do they have to call somebody, and they have to call somebody, and they have to call headquarters, and they call them back, or do they get that information in some kind of report that tells them on a dashboard where they're at? We are working with our Department of Transportation. You've funded in the last session a joint ERP project, or we call it a joint ERP project, but the Department of Transportation is working on an enterprise resource planning a module to have an integrated information system within their agency, and the Department of Administrative Services is working with that to build those horizontal linkages for those business processes that run across the enterprise, connect that up. And our Human Resources Division has a funded project in place to together at least the requirements in the first stage of a human resources module that will extend out potentially across all agencies to help them in the area of human resource management to get the information and tie those systems together with how they conduct their business. So that's a good example of what we're doing in Objective 2.2. Objective 2.3 is enabling system integration and data sharing across agencies and jurisdictional boundaries. This is this cross-sharing information, and there it depends a lot on getting off the ground with enterprise architecture, and it also requires us to go in and inventory the systems and understand what the barriers are for data sharing. There's a good example of a project that you've funded that's going forward in this area as well, and it's the e-permitting project that DCBS is looking at, and that's a good example not just of state agency jurisdictional sharing, but really of jurisdictional boundary sharing from counties on into the state government. So I think the public expects to see us using wise use of their information and expects to see us leveraging these kinds of projects that get good results at all level of government. The last objective in this category is preparing state government for best value evaluation, acquisition, procurement, use of both open and closed source software. So this really is twofold. It's one, how do we ensure best value procurements and how are we making good procurements around information technology? And then what about open source? How are we looking at the opportunities for open source? Does open source really provide opportunities for us? So we have a community of practice. They are engaged in this right now. They have three elements that they are focused on. One of them is an inventory of open source software, which has been completed. The second is understanding what the procurement and licensing implications are around open source so that we are appropriately using open source software in accordance with any licensing obligations that would be required, and that it is procured appropriately. And finally, we're looking at how does this software, what's the opportunity for using this software? So we have a team that's looking at an assessment model to figure out whether this works or doesn't work and provides opportunity for state government. Where I think this ultimately goes for us is another element that's not right now in our plan but will be in the next probably 6 to 12 months, and that is a policy around open source software use. So some of the open source has become ubiquitous, but as we use open source, we need to understand what the policy implications are. So if we're using it, we've made a good decision, a conscious decision to use it, and we're consistent with any of the licensing requirements of that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before you go further, I'd like to focus on 2.1, yes. Enable system integration and data sharing across agency and jurisdictional boundaries. Is this, and I'm not real clear on how the system works, does DAS respond to requests, or does DAS see issues and lead out to solve them in this area? For instance, Gary Weeks once told me that, you know, he's been director of different agencies, yes. That every time he got a new job, he had to go and do his fingerprint or thumbprint again because it was a different agency. And there's when there's employees within our system, mm-hmm. Do we have to go and, I mean, is every agency a silo, or is DAS working to make information available if you have the same employee with different job assignments, different agencies? I mean, that's just one area, but I'm just trying to understand how DAS is going about doing this.
And this is with respect to Objective 2?
Having data sharing across agency and jurisdictional boundaries.
Mm-hmm. Well, at this point, we know there's a need there. It's understanding what that data is and how it can be shared. I think Director Weeks's point is well taken, that the systems largely in Oregon state government have grown up through the individual agencies. And so we have a variety, kind of an eclectic mix in some cases, of systems that support the agencies but don't necessarily talk well or integrate between them. So for us, I think it's going back and understanding what the business need that's common with those agencies that needs to be connected at an enterprise level, and begin to understand how we map to that and what the opportunities are to go forward to begin to integrate those. And then I think it's adopting an architecture standard that says, as we replace these systems, we replace them in a way that they have that kind of interoperability. It's important as well not to go too far down into the agency stack of applications and their work, because in some cases it doesn't have enterprise-wide implication. And I think the fear is there that DAS will come in and tell us how to do everything all the way down to this detailed level that they certainly won't get right, because we're the only one that have that mission. And that's the kind of, and that's a detail that we wouldn't want to go to. So we want to look at what those cross-agency opportunities are, begin to understand how we take those on, and then which ones of them go first. And I think there's a lot of work to be done there, and we're not very far down at this. I mean, we don't even have an integrated email system. We have a variety of different email systems. So there are a lot of opportunities here. I think what's important is having a plan, beginning to make progress about the plan, having some success to execute it, learn how you've done that, and then move to the next step to do more of it.
Part of what I heard in his question was, is this reactive or proactive?
Mr. Chairman, I think it's a little bit of both at this point. I think in some cases it's reactive. We will talk later about a community of practice around enterprise information or records management. In that case, the questions come up, we've got these new issues, how can we get involved? We've created a group looking at that to make a recommendation about what kinds of things make sense for us to do at the next step from an enterprise level to begin to lay the foundation to move that together. So in one case, it's reactive. In other cases, we've tried to look out over the horizon and see where there are opportunities, and we propose some of those opportunities. We have a set of collaborative tools that we're meeting with the administrative service managers and the CIOs on right now to put online different sets of documents that allow us to have messages going back and forth between different agencies and putting documents up that we can work on at the same time in a collaborative way and share that, as opposed to the way email works now. This puts that up and allows us to collaborate. So in some cases, we've tried to propose those to be proactive. From my perspective, business should drive information technology, and information technology needs to be an enabler. So we have to be a little bit careful about how far out we're looking over the horizon to make sure that it actually meets the needs of a business. So that's a little bit of both.
Yes, Representative Edwards.
Follow-up question on that, what you just said. So are agencies coming to you with a vision and saying, you know, if we could just do this better, or if our technology allowed us to do this, boy, we could, you know, reduce, you know, their cycle times within their agency, or, you know, we could improve customer service, or we could do this or that. I mean, are they demonstrating vision and the knowledge of what's out there and what's the potential is with information technology to even know what it is that they could be envisioning?
Yes, we'll hear that. I'll give you a case in point. Forestry has come to us and asked us where we're at in terms of producing a web-based conferencing tool, because they have that need within their organization. The agency's visions about information technology are largely driven by their business requirements, and so not all agencies behave the same way in that regard. Some of them have focuses in different areas, and so we will get that. In some cases, the way the project structure is set up, for DHS, for example, they'll have a major project that they'll need to do that primarily supports what DHS does. So they'll move that forward as an enterprise project. They'll put together a request. They'll put together a budget document, and we will then review that IRR request We'll review it against what we know is out there. We'll make recommendations on it. When that is approved and if they get funding, then they'll pursue that. So that too can come in both ways. But the vision that the agencies tend to see their business within their functional silo. Now we have some organizations that we have a Chief Information Officers Council where we meet on a monthly basis, and we try to share those visions in ways that we see what the opportunities are for cross enterprise projects. But it's much easier, I think, to do a single agency project that meets a business need in a single agency than it is to begin to orchestrate a project that's cross-cutting across the enterprise that hits all of them.
Yeah.
The last goal is to optimize the efficiency and cost-effectiveness of government infrastructure and services. And there are six objectives here, and these largely play out to programs that are in place right now in state government executing in this area. The first one is Objective 3.1, and it's identifying, prioritizing, and developing detailed plans to act on opportunities for consolidation and shared services in the state data center. A number of projects going on within the state data center to develop that technical architecture that enables them to bring the 11 separate data centers that they brought in to a lift and drop into one consolidated data center, which provides tremendous efficiencies by operating better utilities, better utilization of the server, really less of a server footprint, less of an energy footprint. And that really is a foundation piece about where we go in information technology in this state, because once that's done, then that gives us a platform to begin looking in a meaningful way at things like email consolidation, because we'll have a platform that can support that. So this is a key piece of putting this infrastructure in place that needs to be done.
No, I haven't looked at the actual budget, and so I'm not familiar with whether or not the consolidation has actually done what its intention was to save money and to be a better utilization of resources. Has that worked out?
Well, I think they've made terrific strides in the data center. They're delivering a service. I think the quality of service is equal or better than what was there before. They're beginning to get security architecture in place that didn't exist before. They're building a new funding model that has to happen with any new business that takes place. They're tracking their costs. I think they've accomplished what they hope to accomplish at this stage for in terms of performance. Whether or not the savings hit the target that they initially projected, I don't think they were at where they hoped to be when this project began. But on the other hand, they are making big strides and big changes that will, in my estimation, ultimately produce cost effectiveness for that operation.
We're talking about the state data center has met its goals in actually being more economic and not just more efficient.
Good. The second objective of this goal is providing cost-effective and reliable online government services, and this really goes to the e-government program, as we call it. It has two sort of parallel components to it. One of them is Oregon.gov. It's the content management database that allows all these different aggregate pieces of information to come together on a website, moving that to a dynamic website that allows people to make changes and conduct business online is a very important piece of that. The other side of it is the e-commerce piece, and it is how licensing or different transactions can take place where there's some kind of monetary exchange taking place. And that has tremendous opportunity not only to streamline processes, but to put into place some fairly rigorous business rules around accounting that make sure that we have the kind of quality assurance in our accounting, and we meet the accounting rules so that we actually have a stronger accounting system as a result of that. I think we're just beginning to to touch the surface on this one. This is going to be more and more important in how people connect to government in the future. You know, we've talked about generational issues around employment. The people of my generation probably have a tendency to want to look at websites and see static information, but we probably don't go on websites as often as the generations following us. And how those future generations begin to engage in government and how they expect government to be interactive with them in a large part depends on how well we play out this role here. And I think it's going to be very important because the generation of citizens coming up today are people who are highly mobile, they are technically very savvy, and they engage through their information technology tools in a very different way than people of my generation. And so that creates some significant challenges for how we continue to be dynamic in this area and put together an interface that can not only just give people static information, but can begin to interact with them in a vital and effective way. I think people view their institutions that go out and look at the web, they view it in comparison to, you know, what the latest and greatest thing is. And so their expectations of how government operates may be the same as they would expect Amazon.com to operate or how eBay would operate. And those are some big challenges for us to stay in that league. But that's kind of the expectation. And so if this interface with government that we're providing that doesn't give them that kind of same look and feel, they'll be frustrated. So there's a big challenge here, and I think that this will become more and more of a key touch point with how well we connect to the citizenry. So one of the things that we're doing is we're revisiting and developing an e-government strategy that's vetted and fits into that governance model we talked about. Another thing that we're doing is we have a contract with Portland State University to begin to take a look at portfolio applications that ought to be part of our e-government suite. Well, usually those are the kinds of applications that agencies say, you know, we want to put this kind of application forward. Well, we're going to be working with agencies on that, but we're also going to be working with citizens. We'll have some focus groups to work with to say, what are you looking for from government in terms of e-government applications that you're not seeing? So we're going to begin to connect up that from both directions, and I think that's an important way of engaging and making e-government more meaningful to the constituencies. Objective 3.3 is building a statewide interoperable wireless network to serve public safety. We have and California has a fire crisis situation right now where they're being challenged. That kind of situation, fortunately, we don't so often have here. In fact, we've never seen anything like that. But that would certainly test our public safety interoperability network. So this is a key piece of the strategy. The last two of them are key elements that we're providing in EISPD and our division. 3.4 is to ensure the continuity of state government operations in the event of a disaster. We have a business continuity plan in place. We are a planning program in place. We're working with each agency in state government to have a business continuity plan in place for that agency by July of 2009. So we're working to facilitate that. We're working to track that. We're working on training and tools available to help those agencies be successful in developing their business continuity plans. And I might add that this is not kind of a, well, we get there, we put it on the shelf, and we're done. This is a different way of operating, and we have to bring this into our daily operations to have these plans and continue to have them, because when there is a crisis or when there's a disaster, people expect government services to be provided in a responsible, effective way, and we need to prioritize and understand how those are. So this gets to that.
Question, Mr. Chair. Representative Andrews, go ahead.
Thanks. So following up on that, you said this isn't going to be something that just goes on the shelf. It's talking about differences in operations. So are you talking about actually restructuring how folks are operating on a day-to-day basis so that during times of of disaster, their operating standard operating procedure takes them through those times of disaster. I mean, could you expand on that a little bit more? I'm not sure.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Edwards, we in the business continuity planning process, we believe that the agencies should have prioritized their essential functions that they would deliver in 48 hours, 72 hours, or maybe 2 weeks, and that they ought to have their information systems, disaster recovery plans set up in sync with that, so that in the event that there is an earthquake or a windstorm or any number of different contingencies, that they should be able to understand what critical functions that they need to have up and running and when. And it wouldn't be it wouldn't just be to recover the whole organization. It might be that some part of the organization sets up in a different location and makes themselves available for key services that that particular organization needs to provide. And we think that every state agency needs to have those so that they understand what their essential elements are that they must deliver, how they're going to deliver them, and have a plan ready to do it. And they change. Government changes all the time, and people change, and those plans need to be updated and kept up to date. The challenge around that is really the number of scenarios you're preparing them for, because depending on the scenario, the plan you deliver can change somewhat. So we're looking right now to have that first BCP plan set for all agencies in July of 2009, and then to take it from there and say, all right, what are the next steps? How do we resolve conflicts between the plans? What are the priorities on dependencies? If a plan, if an agency has a need for, say, hypothetically, the DAS motor pool, and some other agency has a need for it, who gets priority when we run out of vehicles? So those are some of the ongoing efforts that will have to take place. Maybe one of the most important objectives in this area right now is 3.5 is to secure, protect the confidentiality, integrity, and availability of state information resources. In the last 5 years, there's been a tremendous push, and I think rightly so, on understanding what our security vulnerabilities are, protecting our data and information, and also maintaining the privacy of citizen information that we are entrusted to and stewards of. And so we have a fairly significant effort in place. In this last year, we've adopted six information security policies that address not just data information, but all information. They involve classifying that information, understanding who the information owner is, how we transport the information, employee security, storage devices, as well as an acceptable use policy on how we use our data systems. So these are...
Representative Richardson has a question.
Mr. Penny, with the Real ID Act having been passed and the federal government asking for a format which is easily utilized by agencies in all 50 states, the territories, and the federal government, not allowing encryption and those kinds of things, how are you dealing with that? I mean, it's one thing to say we're going to maintain a focus on protecting confidentiality and so forth, but how does that coordinate with what is being asked of Oregon by the Real ID Act?
Our Department of Transportation, our Division of Motor Vehicles, is actually handling the Real ID Act. And so if I tried to answer that question, I'd give you some probably poor information on that. So I'd be happy to connect with them and get back to you on that. But what we're looking at here is kind of a global view across the enterprise of how we're managing our information security and how we are being appropriate stewards of the public's information and protecting that information. Certainly those requirements overlay on driver's licenses, but the actual implementation on their strategy for implementing Real ID is something that would be best spoken of by DMV.
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to comment to our committee that, you know, of course, the weakest link, it doesn't matter how strong the chain is, if you have one really weak link, the whole chain falls, and the IT focus and area that, you know, responsibility that we have as a committee needs to be fully aware of what's going on in the area of Real ID because of the jeopardy that it places our citizens as far as their information and so forth. I think we need to be careful.
I couldn't agree with you more.
Okay. And Mr. Chairman, last objective is continuously improve the use of information technology in support of state government programs and services. We have a number of community practices looking at information security assets, how we classify information security, electronic records management. We've got a group of people looking at this notion of electronic records and saying, what can we do as an enterprise to position ourselves to have an electronic records approach that provides for transfer of records between agencies? How do we protect those records? How do we search those records quickly so that we can get information if we're asked for under discovery rules? The federal government has changed their rules of discovery, which has implications for us and how we retrieve electronic records and store electronic records. And finally, and electronic records, what are we doing with all of these emails that have been piling up as records, and how do we begin to manage that? So this group is looking at that area. We have a service management pilot looking at the idea of running a pilot for a single instance of a help desk. We have not only a help desk in the state data center, but most of the agencies also have help desks coming into them. Is it possible that we can put an application together talking the same language and looking at the same application to knit those help desks together? So those are some of the areas that we're working on there. To wrap up the Enterprise Information Resource Management Plan, we are developing a tactical action plan which will lay out specific things that we are doing to accomplish these objectives. We review this on a semi-annual basis and update the goals and objectives. And on December of each year, I'll be providing a report on how we're doing against this plan and where we're at, where we've made it, where we've made accomplishments, where we've still got work to do, and how the plan has changed. So with that, Mr. Chairman, that concludes my presentation on the Enterprise Information Resource Management Strategy. I'd be happy to ask any questions on
this. Thank you very much. Anyone have any further questions on this topic? Would the committee like to take a break before we go into the next topic, or do you want to go?
If you don't take a break, I'm heading out anyway, and I'll be back in just a second.
Let's take 5 minutes.
So I vote for break.
Let's take a five-minute break, and then we'll continue.
Thank you.
Next presentation.
Mr. Chairman, you should have in front of you a presentation entitled Contracting Study Report 2005-2006. We'll move to page 2. Just a few background points on this information technology contracting study. In March of 2007, Chair Riley talked to me and asked us to conduct, if it would be possible to conduct, an information technology contracting study. And the purpose of the study was really to better understand the scope and cost of information technology related to outsourcing across state government, and also to determine whether an increase in permanent state agency information technology staff to perform feasible project work had the potential of saving money for the state. Oregon state agencies selectively contract with private sector firms to provide a variety of work, but the two basic categories that work typically falls into are IT project work that have deliverable-based contracts, which are we have a contract that says you will implement this system and deliver X, Y, and Z for a fixed fee. And then another category of work is information technology staff augmentation services. And that work is provided through what's called a managed service provider contract that the Department of Administrative Services established, which allows agencies to go online and match up specific skill set needs to the contractor who has been competitively selected, and that contractor then searches the database and provides a variety of information technology specialists from their skill set that could do that work. And that's on a competitively selected basis and with a competitive fee. So those are the two typical contracts that this study really talks about. On page three, we talk about some of the reasons that agencies contract out for work. It's really short time limitations. They've got to have something up and running, and they just don't have the staff. Or if they do have the staff, they'd have to take them offline to get the work done. So in order to meet that deadline, contracting is the best approach to it. They may contract because they don't have the particular skill sets. It may be for a system or a project that is beyond their skill set capability. They may contract out because they simply don't have the staff resources. They've got a variety of projects that need to be put into place that have been approved, but they don't have the resource bandwidth to do it within their own capabilities and have to add it. Or it might be a category of contract where it's just it's probably inappropriate for them to do it. And the biggest example of that is a quality assurance contractor. Rather than having your own employees do quality assurance, you have an independent third party come in and provide that. It's kind of like an accountant coming in and providing a certified financial statement. You would contract with that, but rather than having your own people do that. So we talked with Representative Riley about how we might structure this. Initially, the request was to look at everything that was technology-related, I think down to $5,000, and we thought, my gosh, how can we possibly do that? We just didn't have the capability of having that kind of view on everything. So we talked about what we could do that would be meaningful to get at this question about what if we'd have the potential of saving money by doing things differently here. And so that resulted in us coming to an agreement to, rather than to go out and try to survey all 100-plus state agencies, but to work with the scenic 12 agencies, which probably have 80% of the contracting activity, and to go out and do a targeted survey to give information. So we did, and we asked for contracting information from them for a 12-month period that was the 12-month that we had data on immediately following Representative Riley's request, which was July 1st of 2005 through June 30th of 2006. So we did send that out. When we sent out the request, for the purposes of this study, we had defined information technology work as projects to develop applications and systems, or non-project work such as system maintenance and support activities that were operational in nature, but all relating to information technology. The participating agencies identified a total of 186 information technology professional services contracts that fit within the survey requirements, and they fell into two broad categories, which were the deliverable-based contracts we talked about, and then staff augmentation contracts. And I've already kind of explained staff augmentation. So let's turn to page five, and I'll give you a picture of what we got back from the agencies. You can see in the left-hand column the acronym for the individual agencies. And then the next column in, moving from left to right, is the total number of contracts. So DAS, for example, had 12 contracts during this period. And the total for all the agencies surveyed were 186 contracts. Well, you might say, because I said this when I looked at the DAS contracts, I said, well, wait a minute, that sounds a little low for DAS. So we got more contracts in place than that. Well, the requirement was, did we establish a contract during this period of time? Because some of these contracts that we have in place might have begun 2 years before and still are running. So we looked for contracts that were awarded during that period of time. And the premise here was to try and get a snapshot of what's happening over any given annual period to see if perhaps we could extrapolate from that. So these were contracts that were began in that period of time. The total value of the contracts was the estimated value of the contracts. So for 186 contracts, the total estimated value is $107,134,536. That's a lot of dollars for 186 contracts. But if you look at DHS, there's an asterisk there, and that asterisk is because this $95 million figure also includes their MMIS contract, which is a very significant contract to carry out federal requirements. And I don't have off the top of my head what the value of that particular contract is, but it makes up a substantial part of that $95 billion. So of those total contracts, 60 of them were for staff augmentation, and that had a total of $2.8 million. We had 14 contracts that were staff augmentations, and they were related to scenic backfills with the end agencies that they had had to backfill after the scenic project staff went over into the other agency because they still had some work going on. We had 126 that were deliverable-based contracts, and they had a total value of $104,000. And in the far right-hand column, we've included the number of information system specialist employees, and these are our state employees within this information system specialist range that each of these agencies have in total. And you can see that there are 701 total for all of the agencies. So those were the general results that we got back. If you turn to page 6, I'll go over some of the methodology here. There were 5 agencies that reported contracts. 5 of the agencies reported 161 of these contracts, so they had 86.6% of the work. And we found, in looking at this, 50 of these staff augmentation contracts provided really the universe of which we were going to do the analysis and the comparison on. The staff augmentation contract, it's important to point out here that unlike the deliverable-based contracts, they're paid on an hourly rate, and that's key to allowing us to do this analysis. So let's turn to page 7.
Question. Representative Edwards.
So just for clarification, staff augmentation contracts are contracts that the state, it's when the state is contracting with somebody else to provide the state with IT professionals.
Yes, that's it. Mr. Chairman, Representative Riley, that's exactly correct.
Okay, got it.
So we had 50 staff augmentation contracts on page 7, and those contracts had a maximum not to exceed hourly rate from the managed service provider, so we knew what the maximum rate was for those contracts. And we then did, we took the staff augmentation rates, and we divided it into the total amount of work for the staff augmentation contract, which then gave us the number of hours that were worked on the staff augmentation contracts. We took those staff augmentation classifications, and we said, how would they compare to a state employee classification? And so we mapped them across. And we basically, as we show on the slide, the Tier 1 staff augmentation contract to the managed service provider, we mapped to an information system specialist 6. Now, that might not be a perfect match, but at a high level, that's a pretty good way of equating it. And then the Tier 2 staff augmentation contractor, which has a different rate, we map to the information system specialist 7, and the Tier 3 to the highest range we have in the information system specialist, which is an 8. And so that gave us the number of hours we had and the type of work that was performed on a staff augmentation contract. And then we took those number of hours and said, all right, if we had done this with a state employee, how much would it have cost? So we took the fully loaded rate of the state employee's time, the information security specialist 1, 2, or 3, and in that fully loaded rate, we had the benefits in it, we had the retirements in it, we had overhead in it, and we multiplied that times the number of hours that we had extrapolated out of that staff augmentation to see if we'd done it in-house, would it have cost us more, would it have cost us less. So he'll turn to page 8. I don't have that cost more or cost less answer, but I can show you a little bit of the dilemma that we found ourselves in, because so far so good on matching those classifications up. We think that makes sense. Then the question is, well, what pay range, what step would these classifications be paid at? And so for a while we're thinking, Well, they're probably the entry level. They'd probably be step one, step two. Well, if you look at what we've got here, we took the total of all of our ISS staffing and we broke them down to see what steps they're in. And so if you total this up and you look down at the bottom, you can see that 80.3% of all of our ISS staffing are at step 5 to step 9. And in fact, if you look out here at step 9, you can see that in total, 43% of our ISS staffing is at step 9. So more of our staff is at the end of their step schedule than at the beginning. So that makes a difference, because if we had used a step 1 or step 2 number as the multiplier, then it shows that the state employee rate for doing this work is lower. If we go out to step 9 and use a multiplier, then it's much higher. So how do we play this distribution? So what we did was we said, well, we think the range probably is going to be between step 5 and step 9. And what we actually did was we used the calculation at step 5, we used the calculation at step 7, and we used the calculation at step 9 to see whether there were savings generated or not that gives us a range. So I'm going to skip over these next two slides, but they are 9 assumptions that we made in this report that are critical. And for example, we're saying that the in-house full-time employees with the requisite IT skills will be available, because if we can't get the people we need to hire in the ISS system, then this breaks down. We're also making the assumption that we're going to have 100% utilization of the position. And so, for example, if we have 100 employees, but we only have 50% utilization for whatever reason, I think that's a low utilization number, but then we really only bring to bear 50% of those 100 or 50 employees that can actually do the work. So we've assumed 100% capability, which means that they could come off of one project and go into another project without any lost time. So you can see what the assumptions are that we've made in this report, and they are critical, because you start changing the assumptions, then the outcomes of the report change. But let's skip over those two, unless there are any questions about it, and we'll just move to what we saw in the results.
Mr. Chairman Richardson.
Ms. Pettit, as I look at the various steps, I mean, step 4 has more than 5 or 6. You've got over 61 or 2% just in 8 or 9. And so it seems like with such a loaded rate at 8 and 9 that you'd be using that rather than 5.
They do it for each of the 3 steps.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Richards, you're exactly right. That caused us not to pick one right answer out here, but to have a range. And I think you can't really look at that range without looking at these steps at the same time. Okay. So let's turn to page 11 and actually take a look at what the results told us. Of the 5 agencies that we had the 50 staff augmentation contracts on, if you go over from left to right, the third column shows the value by agency of the contracts that we compared. So we know that in total for those agencies we had $2.5 million that we expended as using the staff augmentation approach. And then we did the calculation to say, all right, we took those hours out of it and we multiplied that times the appropriate ISS classification at step 5. And it looks like at step 5, the total cost would have been $2.1 million. So the potential savings is right at 14.6%, and for all the agencies in total, it's $365,000. But that's at a step 5. So to get to Representative Richardson's point, if you move over to step to the last two columns, and you look at it cumulatively down at the bottom, you'll see that if they were at step 9, if they were all calculated at step 9, then the cost using state staff would have been $2.4 million, almost $2.5 million, as compared to the original 2.5, and the savings would have been only $9,000. Now, those are totals, and that's probably the appropriate way to look at this, because I think there's a danger of getting too far down to make any kind of conclusion from. But if you do look at it by agencies, you can see that in some cases, for example, with the Department of Transportation, if those positions were at step 9, that it would have actually cost them money in that case. But that's the only case where it showed to be a negative. So what are the conclusions from this? Well, on page 12, we've talked about it. We have, from the 50 contracts that we compared, the value of that work was $2,508,000. And from the data that we analyzed on those 50 contracts, depending on whether they're at step 5, 7, or 9, the range of potential savings would be somewhere between $365,000 and $9,000.
If we took out ODOT, even at step 9, we save $100,000 if we take out ODOT.
Yeah, if you were to back them out.
And why is there? I'm sure you've thought about this a lot. Why is there so much different?
I think part of the reason that the Department of Transportation was different is that if you look at the total number of contracts, you see that they do significantly more contracting. And my understanding was some of their baseline contracting, they actually negotiated a better price than the managed service provider contract was. They used that and negotiated down from that. So these rates may show a better rate on their part.
Question?
Yes, Representative Edwards.
Would you expect that over time, if more of this work was done in-house, that you'd have step migration over time? I mean, you know, the average, you know, if the average employee was a step 5 today, and you create these career jobs within the state, and then they're going to be, the average is going to continue to creep up. Is that a safe assumption, or?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Edwards, yes, that's a safe assumption unless they're topped out. However, it's a dynamic environment because the managed service provider contract isn't static either, and so over time that rate changes, and probably not going down; it goes up. And then on top of that, you have the labor negotiations, which, in addition to any kind of a step increase, most of these are represented employees, so their rate may go up as their labor contracts go up as well.
On the other hand, there will certainly be turnover, and the people who leave or retire typically are at that top level,
right.
and most of the time are replaced with employees at lower levels.
That's correct. So, Mr. Chairman, just to conclude, on page 13, the base assumptions, based on the assumptions that we made and the scope of the study, it does appear that performing more work in-house in lieu of staff augmentation contracts does have the potential of saving money. That's what this seems to show us. Increasing information system specialist staffing and current classification scheme can address some project demands, but there will always be a need to do some contracting work. It won't completely remove the needs of an agency to do work. It's still the same question about do they have the staff, do they have the skills. It may be, for example, the MMIS system that's being contracted for by DHS. It's unlikely that they would have been able to approach that by hiring a bunch of staff to do that internally. This doesn't really address the deliverable-based work, and most of the agency dollars are spent in deliverable-based work. And why that's so hard to get at is contractors generally don't share with us all their rates for what they pay people, nor do we have the ability to know how many hours they may have put into a given project. Their responsibility is to do the delivered work, at the price that they bid for that work. And if it takes more time and effort than what they bid for, then they may have to get in their pocket. On the other hand, if they can do that more efficiently, maybe they've made money on it. Mr. Chairman.
I represent Redwood School.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are most contracts receiving multiple bids, or do you just have one contractor that typically it's a...
Mr. Chairman, Representative Edwards, it's, I think, a rare exception when there aren't multiple bids received on contracts. And from my experience, if you don't get multiple bids, you may very well want to go back out or ask some real hard questions why, because chances are that's not in the state's best interest to make that award.
Yes, Representative Richardson.
I was thinking about the assumptions that you made, and I assume that there is some guidelines as far as the effectiveness or the efficiency of a worker. You said you're assuming 100% efficiency, that when one project ends, another project immediately begins. What is the guideline on that? How is this? 80%? Is it 60%? Is it, you mentioned 50% of them? What the assumption will control the outcome? So I'm trying to test your assumption and have you tell us what it is in the industry.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Richardson, I'm not sure I can give you an industry standard and industry practice around this, and that in itself probably would have been a study that we, given the time and the resources we had available to do this, we just had to make some assumptions. I have had some experience in the past around trying to build rate models for printing and distribution operations, and this question of productivity and employee utilization is a difficult question. The times that I have done this, I've looked for that standard, and I've got different ranges, and it's hard to know unless you actually measure the organization's productivity and how effectively utilized the employee is. But it's probably I think what we've done here is we've just made that assumption, and we made that assumption clear that that's what this is based on. If we were going to discount it, you could pick some kind of range and say if it's 80% or 75%, we could back that into it and pretty easily come up with a different number.
Yeah, what we're really talking about, it seems, is the time in between projects.
That's
correct. Because you have the same inefficiency in employees whether they're working for you or they're working for someone else. That's not an issue. The issue is the time between projects. Talk to us a little bit about the possibility of sharing among agencies.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you think back to that earlier presentation, we talked a little bit about that objective on recruiting and retaining and selecting qualified staff. Well, one of the activities that we see to carry out that objective is the idea of beginning to try and capture in a database what agency skill sets, what skill sets and project skill sets exist within state government in this area, and then being able to act as a clearinghouse to put that information available so that if Department of Human Services has a need for a project manager or certain ISS skills, and the Department of Transportation has somebody potentially available, that they'd be able to see that and begin to match that up. Now, we have a practice that's been pretty well refined in state government that is called a job rotation practice, where an agency can execute an agreement with another agency and they can bring staff over to work on a particular project or work in a different section for a while. A lot of times that's done to give them growth opportunity or management opportunity, and it can be a pretty effective tool. So we think there's an opportunity here to use this clearinghouse notion of finding out who the people are and what the skills are that are available, beginning to track that and then couple that with more of a streamlined job rotation process that will allow one information technology manager in one agency to see that there's somebody coming off of a project that might be available and then easily connect up with a job rotation.
So you'd put on this database the skill set of each employee, for instance, and note when they're projected to become available from the project they're working on.
That's right. And finally, I guess the last point here is that the volume of the contracting work is going to fluctuate over time. It's very dynamic, and it's driven by the agency business needs and driven by decisions that the legislature make about what the program should be doing and where it should be going.
Okay. It's clear to me, at least, that we're always going to be doing some contracting. I see no question about that. And the goal of your agency and of our committee should be to make sure that we get the work done in the most efficient and cost-effective manner we can for our constituency.
Absolutely.
Did you have anything further?
That concludes my report, Mr. Chairman.
Questions? Thank you very much. I really appreciate you being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
What's next on our...
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, your final item on the agenda is a discussion about possible legislation for February of 2008. And I'd like to call your attention to a letter from Representative Thatcher that's in your packet, and I know that she also emailed that to you.
Yes. And has everyone seen that letter?
Mm-hmm.
I haven't discussed this with everyone, but I have discussed it briefly with Vice Chair Richardson, and I, for one, believe that there's some good things in this letter, especially the first item. I would think that the overwhelming way that we sent this off the first time we looked at it would indicate that it's a good bipartisan bill that should at least get another look. And I'm leaning personally towards that. I don't want to, I guess, make a decision today, because what I'd like from you all is to take the next few weeks and, you know, tell me where you would like to be, if you have ideas. Do we have a deadline?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I believe the 15th of November, or no, that's for the Senate. No, you have a couple of weeks. However, the committee would have to approve a request to legislative council. So, again, we would have to have a committee meeting to make a request.
Okay.
I don't believe you have a deadline.
Clarify.
Yes.
What you're talking about, 2550, is that the number? Or are you?
No, I'm talking about Senate Bill 1039.
Okay. And it would be helpful for me, as we're looking at this, to see the letter that came with the governor's veto.
Mm-hmm.
Can you get that?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. So the issue here is that If we don't decide something today, and then we have to call another committee meeting in the next 2 weeks.
Yeah, by Thanksgiving, my understanding.
By Thanksgiving.
Well, the teens.
Okay, in the next 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Would that not be assuming that you have to have a meeting to come up with that decision? I mean, this is a new experience of having the first, you know, this short session in February. The directive from the speaker is that the chair will make a recommendation, and if your goal is that it be something that we all agree to,
it's certainly my goal.
Yes,
you're right. It's certainly my goal that
we mostly agree. and at least three of us. So,
well, that changes. If the goal is that it can be a totally partisan bill, then that would have an effect, actually.
Well, I don't want it to be a partisan bill. What I personally would like is for all of us to agree.
Right.
Short of that, because we may never all agree, okay, you're aware of that possibility.
Well, if you're going in this direction, I think that there's Representative Thatcher is likely to support it.
Right.
and I think it makes sense. I guess what I'm suggesting is that if you have unanimity in your conversations with us, then you don't need to hold a committee meeting.
Correct. I agree with that.
So that might save.
Right.
I would like to check in with the Speaker's office on that, but it sounds reasonable at this point.
Okay.
It's really more the getting a draft as opposed to bill introduction, because then you do have to have the meeting to do a bill introduction.
Right.
But not necessarily.
Well, my understanding is the committee would have to approve the request for a draft also. But I think there's a bit of flexibility in that. But I'd like to double check with the Speaker's office.
Until mid-December, because LC is still working on statutes. And so they're not going to do any drafting for another month and a half.
So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, is it my understanding that you're interested in perhaps reintroducing Senate Bill 1039? Is that the direction you're heading?
That's certainly where we're looking at this point.
Okay.
I would want to hear from all the committee members. I've heard from one that's an okay way for us to go. I'd like to hear from the other three. That's a reasonable way for us to go.
I like the concept the first time, that I would like to read the veto letter.
Yeah.
If I remember right, I did read it, and I think I know what it says. But I would like to go back over it and look at it one more time. But, I mean, I would think, though, that the Speaker's office would work with us on this.
Either with us or on us, yeah. Okay. So what I would like at this point is for you to send out an email to all of the committee.
Okay.
I'd like you to resend this out as an attachment to the email.
Sure.
The governor's veto letter.
Mm-hmm.
And a link to the actual language of the bill.
Yep. Senate Bill 1039.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Does that sound good?
Mm-hmm.
If you all could get back to me on this direction is where you'd want to go, or if you have another suggestion, then I'd like, as soon as possible.
Sure.
And I'll be out of the loop November 3rd to the 18th because of China.
But I already pretty much have your...
You know where I'm standing?
Yes, I got yours. Okay. Okay?
Sure.
Okay, with that, I'm going to adjourn this committee meeting. Thank you.